Welcome to this next session on the book of Ecclesiastes. We left off last time concluding in chapter 5, and we're going to begin in chapter 6 this evening. And chapter 6 starts out by picking up some of the themes that we left off with in chapter 5. But Solomon doesn't say the exact same thing this time around. At the end of chapter 5 in verses 18 and 19, we read, verse 18 says, "Here is what I have seen to be good." This is Solomon here giving kind of his conclusion to the section. "It is appropriate for one to eat and to drink and to see good in all his labor in which he labors under the sun, all the days of his life that God has given him, for this is his portion." Verse 19, "Every man also to whom God has given wealth and riches, he has given him power to enjoy them and to accept his portion and to take pleasure in his labor. This is the gift of God." So let's now launch into chapter 6 with these themes here of wealth and riches. And Solomon's going to pick it back up, but this time he's going to say something unexpected about them. All right, verse 1 says, "There is an evil that I've seen under the sun, and it weighs heavily upon humanity. A man to whom God gives wealth, riches, and honor, so that he lacks nothing for himself of all that he desires, yet God does not give him the ability to eat of it, but a stranger eats it. This is pointless and is a severe affliction." Well, that's a lot different than what he just talked about at the end of chapter 5, with God giving a person wealth and riches and the ability to enjoy them. Here he's saying that there's an evil I see happening under the sun. God gives wealth and riches and honor to somebody, but then doesn't give them the ability to enjoy that. Rather, he blesses the person with these things, but then somebody else eats of it. And he says, this is pointless. So here, Solomon, in his frustration, has basically reached a fever pitch, I think, about what he's seeing around him. And this little anecdote that he offers about this man to whom God has given wealth, riches, and honor, he's using to exemplify, sort of express that frustration. The wealth and the riches and the honor, it says, are given to this person to the degree that they don't lack anything. The person lacks nothing for himself of all that he desires. Basically, he can have everything he wants. God has given him so much that there is no deprivation in it. However, the deprivation is that God didn't give them the ability to enjoy it. So we're talking about a circumstance where a person has this wealth and riches and honor, but is not able to enjoy them in the way that they should be enjoyed, to enjoy the good of them. Now, everything Solomon says is done through a framework, a perspective. And here he's talking about observing a person who he claims is being blessed by God with these things in their life, but they lack the ability to enjoy life with them. The metaphor here of that somebody else is going to eat of it, a stranger, it doesn't just mean some random person. This is just somebody who's like not in the family. And the metaphor of like eating is just to be able to thoroughly enjoy something and to consume it. We're not told why by Solomon that he thinks God has withheld the ability for the person to enjoy the benefits of their work and the revenue and the recognition that is produced by it. But the answer to why is really not the point that Solomon is focusing on here. Instead, he's bewildered at the fact that this even happens at all and what he sees in the world. In his view, it's just a very mysterious and frustrating reality that he says. And he goes so far to even say it's evil and says it's a severe affliction. Now, in Solomon's language, the word evil is not a moral category. He's saying that he sees something wrong. He sees something wrong in the world. And to him, the Hebrew word for evil is the same word as for bad, as the same word as for trouble, is the same word for a lot of different negative circumstances. So let's not think that Solomon is here applying evil in the fact that God has acted in a certain way in Solomon's eyes. It's not that kind of evil. Now, I don't know about you, but when I see somebody who's worked hard for something and then they don't get to partake of it or they don't get to enjoy what they deserve, I feel bad for them. I feel like there is something amiss, something off, as though the world like skipped a beat and they end up getting the short end of the stick. And when this happens to me, I get personally very frustrated with it. I remember this one time I was volunteering to work at a county fair back in Ohio where I grew up. And I volunteered for a shift in the afternoon. And I went there, I helped out and everything. And we were promised to get a voucher for our volunteer work. Well, finished the shift and I eagerly waited for that voucher. And once I got it, I ran to my favorite food stand and stood in line and ordered an elephant ear, which is basically just a large plate of fried dough with cinnamon and sugar on it. Well, to my shock, the voucher was not accepted at this food stand. I didn't know it, but it was only redeemable at the main concession. A little fact that they forgot to maybe tell me or I didn't listen, I don't know. But the disappointment was real. I just slumped my shoulders and just walked away from there because I didn't have enough money to buy it on my own. I was depending on the voucher. So really, it's an unmet expectation. So for somebody who receives all this wealth and riches and honor, and then to not be able to enjoy life with them also carries with it a severe disappointment. Now, in verse 3, perhaps the problem that Solomon sees in described in verse 2 is, well, maybe somebody has a lot of money, reputation and everything, but they don't have any children to pass along an inheritance to or the family name to. So then Solomon now goes on with his anecdote, and verse 3 says, or if a man fathers 100 children and lives many years so that the days of his years are many, but his soul is not satisfied with good things, and moreover, he has no burial, I say that a stillborn child is better than he. For the stillborn comes pointlessly and goes in darkness, and its name is covered with darkness. Solomon points to offspring and children as maybe that's what's missing. Maybe that is the component that a person would need to enjoy life with wealth, riches, and honor. And I think it's not a bad proposal because there's a lot of enjoyment that comes from family. Imagine if you were a patriarch or a matriarch of a clan, a massive clan of people, and you were sitting around a campfire with dozens and dozens of your children, and perhaps their children too, and you're telling stories, and you're making them smile and laugh, and you have a grandkid on one knee and a grandkid on the other knee, and life is good. I'd say that's something worth enjoying. Or if you live in a village and the whole village is your family, your neighbors are your family, the people down the street are your family, the people in the street over are your family, they're all your family. You get to live with family. I think older people draw a lot of satisfaction and enjoyment from being able to spend time with family and seeing their children grow up and have children of their own. I'm a new parent, not a grandparent. My daughter still has many years yet until that time. But in thinking about it, I certainly look forward to the enjoyment of being able to be around a larger family with my children and their children. And perhaps some of you are already at that stage or season of life, and you know what I'm talking about. And so as enjoyable as a large family of children would be, it seems that Solomon's saying that that can't be the answer. Because even if a person had 100 children, so he's exaggerating like crazy. Like this is just hyperbole. Nobody can have 100 kids. But let's say you did. That wouldn't solve the problem in his eyes. He's saying, if you have 100 kids, but your soul is not satisfied with good things, and also you don't have a burial, he says, that a stillborn child is actually better than you. This is a radical illustration for him. He seems to go kind of in this real grisly comparison where somebody who lives a life, a prestigious life filled with wealth and riches and honor, And now a huge family, and if they're not satisfied with the good things in life, if they're not satisfied in life, that someone who actually was never actually alive when they were born is better than that person? Solomon, come on now. Really? He tags on this idea of no burial, which in the biblical culture, to not have a burial was a big deal. Because you could live a long and prosperous life, but at the end of your life, if you're not given the proper burial, it's like the most disrespectful and the most dishonoring thing that could happen to you. So people took very great care to bury people in certain places and in certain ways. That was part of the end of a person's life, kind of like recognizing the end of their life as its greatness. Now, Solomon has already talked about people who have died are actually better off than those who are alive. That was a theme he talked about in chapter 4, where he said, "Therefore I praise the dead," chapter 4, verses 2 and 3. "Therefore I praise the dead who had already died more than the living who are still alive. And better off than them is both the one who has not yet been, the unborn, who has not seen the evil things that are done under the sun." So Solomon is saying that it's better for a child to be born not living than to have to go through life in the frustration and the misery with which he sees happening all around him. This evil and this severe affliction that he calls it. He says it's better for somebody to not have to go through that. So he's not deprecating on life or saying that God's vision for filling the world with life is bad and wrong, and it's better for people to not even be born alive. He's not focusing on that sort of approach. He's focusing on the person who gets spared from the agony of what he sees happening under the sun. That person, he says, is exemplified in a baby who doesn't ever have to live. That baby gets spared, and the person who has to go through life is the one who suffers. He explains the reason why here is that the stillborn child doesn't see the sun, so it doesn't live, and it doesn't know anything. Yet, that stillborn child has more rest than the other man with riches, wealth, and honor, even if that person, that man, lives 1,000 years twice over and yet fails to enjoy the good things. Do not all go to one place? So if it's not just having children, then what about if somebody has children and lives like essentially forever almost? Is that what would do it for Solomon? Would that solve the dilemma? Well, his comparison here is that you could have 100 kids and you could live 1,000 years. Hey, let's just say you live 1,000 years twice. I mean, what's the use in doing it over, you know, a second time? It's not going to change anything in his view. The answer for Solomon is no. All the money in the world, all the good reputation, the abundance of children, if the person is still missing the enjoyment of the good things in life, then 2,000 years doesn't matter. 2,000 years is not going to get them to that point. That person ultimately has no peace and no rest if they're not able to enjoy life. They cannot ultimately find what they're searching for. So therefore, living the greatest life, the most plush life with everything you want, but without the good things of life, it doesn't matter because everyone goes to the same dark place, he says, the grave. This is a common trope in a lot of novels and movies, actually, this idea of being able to like live a very long time, essentially become immortal. And somebody who's immortal and has lived thousands of years, perhaps, and maybe has wealth beyond imagination or has done everything that can be done under the sun. These people are often depicted as people who live unfulfilled lives. They become apathetic. They become despondent because even though they've lived so long and done so many things, what they really need is missing. They can't find it. And then they begin to loathe their immortality because what they want can't be found in this life. And therefore, they don't know why they should keep going on as they are. And in some of the tropes, they actually long to become mortal again. so that they could actually experience the transitoriness of life and the good things that they can't have with the immortality that they've achieved. And so Solomon here is basically just saying that long life doesn't get you where you want to go. You could have money, you could have family, you could have a long life and still come up empty-handed. Now, in this frustration of life that Solomon is going through and kind of showing us sort of some of his despair about it all, he then changes now and starts talking in a different mode. In verse 7, he kind of just moves on and talks then about a comparison. And his comparison deals with the value of wisdom. And is wisdom really helpful to him in trying to answer this question about the profit and meaning of life and whether you can actually have good, you can enjoy the good of life with wisdom? He says in verse 7, all the labor of man is for his mouth, and yet the appetite is not filled. For what advantage has the wise more than the fool? What advantage does the poor man have who knows how to walk before the living? So let's pause there. In broad terms, Solomon is attributing here the reason for all the human work is to satisfy a person's mouth, to satisfy his desires, his appetite. And here he has both physical, referring to like hunger and things like that, but I think also it is broader, more in just the total sensual desire category. So eating, drinking, and other pleasures. And that a person can labor all day long. All the labor that they do is to satisfy their mouth, but their appetite is not filled. That they actually can't come to satisfaction in their desires. That they will work, and then they will feed themselves or indulge in desires, and then the desires return, and they do it all over again. They work, and then they indulge themselves in desires, and then they can do it again. It's a vicious cycle, he says, that is never ending. So if it's never ending and no one is ever completely content, then this inability to find satisfaction is another frustration for Solomon. And so then he questions, he's like, well then, what advantage is there to being wise more than being foolish? He's looking at, can wisdom provide a way to material riches? And that's a big thing in like the book of Proverbs, that being wise results in success and prosperity. So if you're wise and then you gain all these material goods and you're able to, you know, feed yourself and enjoy life in that sense by trying to satisfy your desires, but if you can never actually satisfy your desires, then what good is it being wise if you're just going to end up being uncontent and discontent at the end? The wise and the fool end up in the same place, unfulfilled desires. So what advantage is there then for wisdom? And he's basically saying there is none. Because if the goal is to try to satisfy your desires, wisdom and foolishness both find their way to the same end, which is they're still unfulfilled. Their appetite still lingers. And then also he moves on from wisdom and foolishness to the poor person who has wisdom. And if the poor person knows how to walk before the living, implicitly it's like walking with wisdom before the living, meaning, you know, the rest of humankind, those who are alive, what advantage do they have? Well, if they walk wisely, then he would presume that they would then become wealthy. They would then gain material goods. But then again, if the poor person knows how to walk wisely, but yet ends up not being able to fulfill their desires, then the poor person doesn't need to. They can just remain in their current circumstances because the desires are going to remain all the same. So he's basically trying to say that there's no change happening between all these different categories of people and the way that they're living. People work, people feed themselves, but their appetites are never filled. That's his premise. And now he throws a proverb here at the end in verse 9. So then he says, better is the sight of the eyes than the wandering of the desire. This is also pointless and hurting the wind. We've read that before, haven't we? That seems to be Solomon's calling card on everything in life. It's pointless, and it's like trying to herd the wind. This proverb, this is a better than proverb, better is the sight of the eyes than the wandering of desire. The essential meaning of this proverb is that what is visible in front of you, the sight of the eyes, what you can see right in front of you, is better than or superior to the wondering of desire, meaning what you could possibly have, hypothetically speaking. So maybe you could say that what is in the hand and what you have is better than what you might think you could have, but yet don't. You might have heard the common, maybe modern proverb that a bird in the hand is better than two in the bush. So what you have, even if it might be less than what you could have, is still better because it's with you. And there's another story that sort of, like, I think, captures this idea. There's a lot of short stories by Aesop, an ancient writer, called Aesop's Fables. And one of them deals with this idea, and I just want to read it to you. It's called The Dog and Its Reflection. And it goes like this. A dog to whom the butcher had thrown a bone was hurrying home with his prize as fast as he could go. As he crossed a narrow footbridge, he happened to look down and saw himself reflected in the quiet water as if in a mirror. But the greedy dog thought he saw a real dog carrying a much bigger bone than his own. If he had stopped to think, he would have known better. But instead of thinking, he dropped his bone and sprang at the dog in the river, only to find himself swimming for dear life to reach the shore. At last, he managed to scramble out. And as he stood sadly thinking about the good bone he had lost, he realized what a stupid dog he had been. Better to realize what is at hand and what you have than to allow your desire to wander, because desires are unfulfilled, and therefore there's no end to where your desire will go. All right, let's turn to the final section here of chapter 6. Solomon says in verse 10, that which is, already his name was called, and it was known that he is man, and he cannot contend with one who is mightier than he. So that which is, so he's just saying kind of like what exists, that's his way of saying what exists, already his name was called. It could be already its name was called as well, meaning that what exists was already known beforehand, because that's a theme in Solomon here in Ecclesiastes, that what will be is what has been. So it's this whole cyclical effect of there's nothing really new happening. Everything that is happening has already happened and has already been known to happen and will happen again. So that which is already his name is called, and it was known that he is man. He's looking here now at expressing the limitation and finitude of humankind, and particularly with reference to the first man, probably Adam, and that a man cannot contend with one who is mightier than he. It's like an implicit reference to God here. And he's trying to say that mankind, humankind, is limited and is not able to go up against somebody stronger than them, like God. Yet the first man tried to do that and had some really negative consequences happen because of it. And we're suffering from those yet today. So verse 11, there are many things that increase pointlessness. Well, what are these things? Well, they're probably a lot of words, because that was something that Solomon had talked about previously. Many words increase pointlessness. And then he comes back to his programmatic question that he started with back in chapter 1. What does it profit a man? How does all these different things and words, how does it profit a man? Now he'll explain why that's an important question. Verse 12 says, for who knows what is good? There's the issue. Who knows what is good for a man in life? All the days of his pointless life that he makes like a shadow. For who can tell a man what will be after him under the sun? So humans are limited, and they can't compete with God. So then what's the profit? He says, well, the question is answered because a person would need to know the future in order to know what is good, in order to then actually have true profit, the profit that we've been talking about, which would be an actual change in the circumstance and trajectory of life, of which Solomon thinks there is none, because no matter what you do, everybody's going to the same place. Everyone has the same destiny. Death claims everybody, from the rich to the poor, from the wise to the fool, from the king to the servant. And so all the days of a person's life are pointless. They're like a shadow. The shadow, as the sun moves, the shadow just moves along with it, doesn't stay in one place. And then once the sun goes down, the shadow disappears. For who can tell a man what will be after him? That's the question. Is in order to have this good and profit, the future must be known. And then the future must be grasped and brought back into the present, of which no person can do that. This is something that's outside of human ability. It resides in the divine and God ability. But yet Solomon's saying the human can't contend with that. The human can't do those things. So we're left in this limited knowledge and perception of life, of which we don't really know what is good, because humans can't define what is good and determine what is good without knowing the future. So he leaves us with this sort of stupefied question of, well, if it's all pointless, if wisdom is pointless, if money is pointless, if it doesn't matter how big your family is, doesn't matter how long you live, if all of this stuff is irrelevant, well, then where are we supposed to find the good then, Solomon? And to answer that, we're going to take a break and come back in the next session for chapter 7 to continue on with Solomon's thought.